Yes, thank you, Alan, for your vivid and enlightening paper, which outlined within a selection of excellent examples Cooper's premise that the idea of art can be expanded to embrace the whole range of man-made things to nonlinear, recursive, and multidirectional models of design history. I would like to maybe go on a little detour to problematize an aspect that reoccurred through your talk, the concept of culture, but which I would like to maybe approach from a different perspective or different direction, and not particularly from Kubler's concept, but I would like to bring in Bruno Latour at this point. And therefore, I would like to direct the view from the old dichotomy between science and the humanities, between the explaining discipline and the interpretational discipline, to the question in how far the concept of culture may be useful to bridge, also in Kubler's sense, these diverse epistemological systems of science and art. There are many examples that you referred to in terms of the evolution of, let's say, maybe the history of design. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the history of art, I would like to emphasize another aspect, and that is maybe the idea of contingency. And therefore, I would like to briefly go on this detour mentioning Bruno Latour's approach to culture of science, in which he regards as a social practice of experiments and interactions. And instead of a cultural critical position, Latour highlights the social forces at work in and around, for example, Louis Pasteur's career and the uneven manner in which his theories were accepted. In that regard, he counteracts the notion of these purely systematic dimensions of science and its logic and its development or evolution. And in that regard, he undermines the notion that the acceptance and rejection of scientific theories is primarily or even usually a matter of evidence of reason. Latour deconstructs the logic of science, machines, and publications to assume that it is possible to arrive at a point where scientific discovery could have chosen to take many other directions. And I was wondering now if this notion of contingency that he addresses in terms of the social practice of scientific methods might be compatible also to the contingencies that I believe also play a role in the emergence of art, concepts of art.
Oh, those are all really good questions. I think of Bruno Latour as very much in the tradition of Feyerabend, mm-hmm. Which is a fairly skeptical position on positivism. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that struck me particularly about Bruno Latour is that he was, and in terms of this conference where it's pertinent, I think, is the idea of the dissolving of boundaries, that many of the artists' work that I've shown you are working with boundaries that are very much dissolved. Katz and Zura's work, for example, as semi-living form, is a good example of this, something that exists as neither living or as an artifact. And Latour further goes on, as I recall, to talk about accounting for biological prostheses, the fact that if you talk about the history of artifacts in which prostheses has a very large part, whereas before they were external, many of them now are internal. And again, there are artists that are exemplifying this where it's very hard to tell where they stop and where the machine starts, like Stellark is a good example of that. But so I think that he's relevant in terms of the issue of categorization. When you use the word contingency, I really think of Stephen Jay Gould's book talking about the Cambrian explosion and all of the unanticipated examples of early life. And he uses the word to mean the incredible luck, chance, that something was chosen over something else. That's not what I see, however, operating, I have to say, as a practicing artist. Mm-hmm. I don't see this operating in the art market. I see, okay? It's not the open free market, mm-hmm. and it has a lot to do with novelty, with satiation. Somebody gets bored and used to something, and they simply want to change it. They want the novelty, and it thrives. It's a market that thrives on novelty.
But if we take this now, this dimension, when you point to the market, the economical context of the production of art and the distribution of art, the reception of art, then the question arises, and I have to admit I'm not such an immersed Kubler devotee at this point. It still needs some freshening up, I'm afraid, but nevertheless, I wonder how Kubler addresses particularly these circumstances of, let's say, the economical dimension of the situatedness of art, the political, the social, that you
He definitely does. I mean, and he says, in talking about individual artists, mm-hmm. that you enter the flow at a particular mm-hmm. point in time. Mm-hmm. And I think he does, maybe only once in the book, but he does mention mm-hmm. novelty. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, novelty, but I was more interested now in the political constellations, mm-hmm. the social constellations within which art emerges, and also the constraints and the orientation that art takes, particularly in these circumstances of the social context. Could you maybe say a little bit more about that?
I think an example that I gave with the works of Stella Neer, mm-hmm. Or the example also of Inigo Manglana Ovalle adapting castor paintings, which at one point in time, the castor paintings were essentially paintings of race. Mm-hmm. And so he is pointing this out. He, instead of accepting this, he is using a different time and place mm-hmm. to really challenge that.
Well, maybe we can open the floor for questions from the audience.
Well, thank you so much. I definitely agree with you, and I like the way you embedded actually Kubler in the scientific context and beyond. And I must say something perplexed me always reading Kubler, because the connection, of course, with Kuhn and his book is obvious. But he is saying in one passage in his book that a shift of paradigm like that appears in 1910. So he's very much aware of the year 1910 in his book, and that's for him the basic moment to see a change in a kind of looking at the world, or understanding the phenomena of the world. So I'm asking myself, 1910, of course one can immediately go to the idea of the birth of abstract art at mm-hmm. that moment that he might be very well referring to as a change. But at the same time, I'm thinking if you have another ideas, and maybe as I think of now Susan Marchand and her discussion of the intellectual history at that moment, and she's more putting focus on photography, which became to be a very, very popular, a more popular tool to people to work and to look at, even in art history at that moment. But
I don't have his historical knowledge, and maybe you do, of what exactly he referred to as, for him, what the paradigm shift was. Tom? No?
No, I don't remember that particular citation.
Yeah, no, I really can't answer that. But I do know, I looked for a long time to try to figure out what paradigm would translate as, and it's not style. But he actually equated it, perhaps, with a specific work of an artist could serve as a paradigm, which I thought was an interesting idea and probably made a lot of sense in the context of the rest of the book.
I had the honor to visit various times Francis Crick when he was at the Salk Institute. And in his late years, he was very much interested in consciousness. When we went into his office, he had a model on the table which showed the double helix. So I was very happy when you showed his name. I haven't grabbed the idea closely, but let me ask you this. This very model of the DNA, this double helix, would you call this now an artifact?
An artifact?
Yes.
I would call it...
Or is it a model? Because I don't understand quite much the notion of an artifact.
I don't think of it, I would never think of it as an artifact. I would think of it as truly a model. It was a proposal that something worked in a particular way, and it's an idealized.
I don't know, I have the sentence on record, but we ask him often why he has still is on the table. He always kept saying, without this model, we wouldn't have grasped the idea as such.
Well, Rosie Franklin might have another idea better also. I mean, there were a lot of things that led into the discovery of the structure of DNA, but I know Stephen Jay Gould wrote about the importance of modeling, of working this out with their hands, of what this act, how this might work, and he speaks about that. But there's a lot of problems about DNA that remain still unknown, how it unravels. There were something like 30 different structures, one called a zipper model, and a lot of them were rejected simply on grounds that they were inelegant solutions. They were judged, in other words, on aesthetic grounds to work or not work. And we know that if you look at this famous icon of the double helix spiraling, that is nowhere near the reality of what DNA looks like if you look through an electron microscope. I mean, so that it's not the real thing, it's a model of the thing, and it's not an artifact in the sense of a technological artifact. I would say it's something midway between it. I think of I personally have come to think of technological artifacts as, I'll use a word here that you may not use, called affordances. And what I mean by that, or what is meant by that, is that they're an extension of the body, that they carry out something that the body already does, only giving you better access or performing it better. It's any number of things, but the class of artifact I would say, is either an exteriorized or interiorized prosthetic device would cover a lot, but it wouldn't cover everything. It wouldn't cover textiles, although it could include that today. Today it would include smart materials that can make themselves or self-organize.
But I want to join this question, because I can't really see the difference between a model and an artifact. I think a model is a kind of artifact for thinking. It's also an extension of consciousness. It's an image which makes things thinkable, which are not thinkable without this image.
I think if you define it that way, I would agree with you. By definition, if you're defining it that way, then I have to agree with you. That's what he meant.
We never would have gotten the idea, which is in consequence the DNA model.
Right.
But if I may throw something in here, but does it not also transform over time and history in that regard, that this model becomes an emblem as well, you know, a symbolic, charged with symbolic meaning, and therefore, you know, he might have also liked the idea of keeping it, in this function, visible and symbolically referencing this invention or this finding, this scientific finding.
Well, it's true in the sense, I mean, again, by if you're defining it that way, I agree with you, and there's no question that the icon of DNA has evolved itself. It's different now than what it meant in 1953.
But it also has stabilized the way of this whole science around DNA was propagated.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at the Salk Institute, that's still an icon, it's even much more.
Mm-hmm.
Something to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's instrumental.
I think there was a question first.
I just wanted to ask if there I'm sure there are cases when the model of the double helix was reused in art.
Was reviewed?
Reused.
Oh, reused. It's been used many times in art, both on visible and invisible scales. Sometimes if you're talking about art that is using recombinant DNA techniques, sometimes it's not, you have to take the artist's word for it. It's very difficult to tell whether something has been genetically engineered. There could be reasons for some kind of, I spoke with a chemist knowledgeable about this, and he's very dubious, for example, that the manufacture of Eduardo Katz's glowing bunny was really done, and nobody ever saw the evidence of the hair.
Maybe one remark to this question about political and social context and how we can think about them with Kubler. I think it's important that there is a relation between artifact and action. There are many passages where you can find this. The thing is a kind of action or a material form of action, and I think this is one connection. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And cognitive science would agree with that also. That there's a kind of action inherent in materials.
Tom, please.
I think the question of the double helix is interesting, because I think what Kubler might say is that, in fact, as long as that particular model or artifact, you know, limits your vision to think beyond it, that it becomes such a powerful sign that you can continue to evolve it, but then, unless you break it in some way or exhaust it, where do you go? I mean, where does the innovation take place? And that point could be contingency, that you unify another model that's sitting out here with another model that's sitting out there, and you enrich that.
Where does the paradigm shift come from?
Well, he would say, actually, I mean, tonight I'm going to try to talk about Kubler in movement, because we're talking about Kubler in 1961 here. He lives until 1996, and there are a lot of Kublers. So I can't answer it in terms of the shape of time, but I think, well, I think he does talk about that in many ways when he talks about, you know, kind of multiple configurations that exist, right? And actually, the artist can, you know, basically take problems, you know, from different strands of development and reconfigure them in new ways to create an innovation, which is the kind of model I was thinking about with science.
I may just add to this discussion, Thomas Kuhn is trying to answer this question of paradigm shift. And he's saying that for him, at least very roughly speaking, it's the moment when we take away that we look in the present and we look into the past. That means that in a way we take a specific way that we are used to have it in the, we imply the present on the past, and then we can create this kind of a changing paradigms in thinking. So at least that's what Thomas Kuhn. But again, to the question of artifact and model, I mean, it's a fascinating question, and I think that in that case we have also Alfred Gell that we should not forget, and because he, in his The Agency of the Object, he's actually telling us that each object is actually activating us in a specific way of behavior. So even a cup of a tea dictates to us how to move and how to behave with this object, and that change our perception of the whole space in that moment. So there is the connection, I think, between the model and the artifact that one can look at.
Mm-hmm. I think that's what is meant by affordances also, that there is an action implied. Perception implies an action. Yeah.
There's one more question over here.
I just remembered that there are a lot of artifacts which became also models. For example, the computer became a model for the brain. Fortunately, it's over now. But I think it was a model for more than, it was a decade, I think, a long time.
That's a very good point.
It was in the beginning of the computer science.
Yeah, are there any more questions at this point? Oh, Tom, please.
Just a comment. There's this conversation that Kuhn and Kubler had at a meeting, and I thought it was so interesting that Kuhn said that he got his idea for paradigm shifts from the history of art by looking at the schools of painting in Italy. You know, that you would have a Sienese school and you would have a Florentine school, and that this idea of school of scientists, you know, gave him the initial idea. I always loved that he said that.
Well, I think this is already a very good link that leads us into the next session then, your talk after the short break that we will have now. Let me once again thank you very much, Ellen, for this wonderful talk.
Thank you.
And now we will have a cup of coffee or something to drink. Thank you.